All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksteens? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How's everybody holding up? What a fucking travesty. What a fucking murderous shit show this country is. God damn it. Hard to have hope sometimes. I'm the fucking shame to myself because I feel like I'm losing hope in this idea that, you know, we can get some reasonable gun control laws on the books so murderous psychopathic killers can't get guns when they turn 18. Happy birthday, killer. Fuck. Something's got to happen, man. My heart goes out to all the people that lost people. It's fucking terrible. God, every day, man, every day. You got to check in with it. You can't just live in a shell or live in your circle or live in your four block radius. This affects everybody. Oh, my God. I just spent 2 days cooking. Today on the show, Joey Kamen is here. He's one of the Comedy Store originals. He's a guy that I remember watching when I was a doorman at the Comedy Store. He was there a couple years after it started in the mid-70s. I ran into him. For some reason, he always sticks in my head, this Joey Kamen fellow, like what happened to him. He was actually on the old Richard Pryor show. There was a whole bunch of those comics from the mid-70s that showed up on that show because Richard booked them on there. And I just saw Joey at the Comedy Store birthday party, and I was excited. I was like, oh, my God, Joey Kamen. I don't know if he's seen that much excitement to see him in a while. But he also wrote two books, My Life with Snoopy and his autobiography, Laughing Through the Pain, Stories from the Trenches of Hollywood Stand-Up Comedy and Beyond. And I don't know, I just wanted to talk to Joey Kamen. It turned out to be kind of interesting and a little odd, but that'll be happening. Also, look, we announced earlier this week that starting in July, we begin a new partnership with Acast. Some of you saw that tweet, some of you saw the announcement, some of you read the articles. But let's go over what it means for you as a listener. If you listen to the free version of this show, the way you listen doesn't change. Do you hear me? Does not change. A big reason we decided to partner with Acast is we're able to keep the show on all its current platforms. So however you listen to WTF, you can keep listening the way you listen to it. What you will get is many more episodes from the archives for free. We're going to bring a majority of the episodes out from behind the paywall so everybody has access to them. That's going to be a first. Now, for people who subscribe to Stitcher Premium to get our back catalog, WTF will be leaving Stitcher Premium on June 30th. So that's a little heads up if you're on a monthly plan there or you want to make any changes to your account. Okay, June 30th. We're out of Stitcher Premium. Starting July 1st, there will be a monthly subscription option through Acast Plus. You do not need a separate app for this. You do not. When you sign up for Acast Plus, you get your subscription content on your current apps. For Acast Plus subscribers, you'll get every episode in our back catalog ad-free, plus weekly bonus content that we're going to produce exclusively for subscribers. Yes. Now, look, we'll get you more details on all this as we get closer to the launch date, but to recap, here's the deal. If you listen to the show for free, just keep listening. Nothing changes except you'll get a lot more episodes in your feed. If you are a Stitcher Premium subscriber, we'll be off that service on June 30th, and we'll have subscriptions available on Acast Plus starting July 1st. We want to thank Stitcher for their partnership over the years, and a big thanks to Acast for these new options. It's very exciting. Brendan and I are very happy. I hope you'll be happy. It's a nice incentive for us to create more stuff. So I've been home for a few days. I go back out tomorrow. I'll be at the Vogue Theater in Vancouver on Saturday night. I'm looking forward to spending a day in Vancouver. I would have spent more time there. I would have gone out to the islands, but I've been away so much. And the cats are always, something's going on with the cats. The weird thing about cats is cats are fucking weird. They change. They do weird shit as they get older. Or they just decide different things. It's like, oh, I guess you're sleeping there now? When did that happen? All right. And they're a lot more friendly. I think they really, it's hard to tell with cats sometimes, but I think my cats miss me when I'm gone. It's nice. I think they're, I'm happy there's two of them. But, you know, in and out of town. So now the work begins to shave this two-hour set into something very tight, into like a tight 70 minutes as we approach the fall. And hopefully we'll have something for HBO to record. So Joey Kamen, it's so funny. You know, there's still, after we talked on mic, there was off mic stuff. There's just gossip that's gone back in that place since what, 75, 85, 95, 2005, 2000, like 50 years. 50 years, there's still some like, it's weird. You know, it wasn't on mic, but there's still, you know, small beefs. They can last forever, man. Life is short. And if you got a problem with somebody and you can't shake it, you might not. Write that down. Life is short. If you can't muster up an apology, you're just going to have to live with that thing. You're going to take that resentment to your grave. Might not even be real. Anyway, Joey Kamen is here. His books, My Life with Snoopy, and the other book, Laughing Through the Pain, Stories from the Trenches of Hollywood Stand-Up Comedy and Beyond. You can get both wherever you get books. And this is me talking to Joey Kamen. Yeah, I thought when you were doing that voice at the beginning, it almost sounded like Sam, like Kennison. Yeah. And I was like, oh,
Kennison.
Yeah, yeah. But it was a Sam Elliott voice.
Yeah. You want to talk about that piece of shit? Now, I'm about to put my foot up your ass, Marin. I mean, I'll tell you, I wasn't talking about Power of the Dog. I was talking about Joker.
See, yeah. My 2 minutes in Joker.
Now, how did you got to actually see Robert De Niro get his brains blown out, son?
I did, right in front of me. It was crazy.
It was awesome. Awesome.
That's good. That's a pretty good one. But you weren't like when I don't remember, like I've mentioned you on the show before.
Right.
You know, and I guess that got back to you.
Yeah, yeah. I was like I said, very nice of Mark to do that. I'm like, wow.
Who told you?
A buddy of mine, a guy named Adam.
Yeah?
Yeah, he says he listens to your show all the time.
And is he in the business?
Yeah, he's a producer.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And he said, you know Mark Maron?
He goes, Mark Maron mentions you on the show all the time. I said, you're kidding me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why? Why does Mark Maron mention me on the show?
I'm like, well, really?
I have no recollection of Mark Maron.
No, I do. You know, but, you know, it's like we ran in different circles, you know.
Well, I was a kid.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm a few years older than you. I mean, you know, and, you know.
How old are you, Joe?
I'm 65.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I've been doing this since I'm 17.
Well, here's the thing. And I'll tell you, and we'll go back to 17.
Yeah.
Is that like when I was a doorman, you know, I was very impressionable. Like I was ill, I was not quite defined as a human, right? So I was like 21, 22 out of college. Yeah. And I get that job at that weird ass fucking place in 19, it must have been 87, early 87.
87.
Right?
Okay.
And I'm just a door guy.
Right.
And so I, you know, I'm working all the rooms. She made me head door guy. Mitzi did. So I'm seeing the people that are on. And you at that time were kind of in the rotation.
Yeah.
In 87. It was like you, Jan Hart, Karen Haber, Karen Babbitt, Steve Odenkirk, Damon Wayans, Dice. Sam was kind of rising and Dice was kind of rising. Who else was there? Fleischer occasionally. So like I developed some sort of Altman.
Yeah. Jeff. So,
and you know, Jack Perdue, Tim Jones, Johnny Dark, like there, you know, Larry Scarano. But there was this whole crew of these guys that not a lot of people know.
Yeah.
But I got very like I'd see you every like twice a week, three times a week.
Yep.
And so like it, whoever you were and whoever you are, it stuck in my brain. So like you were always a guy that I was like, what happened to that guy? Where's that guy at?
Yeah.
You do all those characters.
Yep.
So where did you start comedy? At the store?
At the store.
So how did you get, like, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Detroit, in the city.
Are you a Jew from Detroit?
Yeah.
A Jew from Detroit?
Yeah, Jew from Detroit, Russian-Romanian Jew.
Yeah, where in the city, though? I was just in Detroit, not that I would know.
Well, but. Yeah, you wouldn't know. I grew up on, like, 6 Mile and on Roselawn, which is like went to Bagley Elementary School, Henry Ford High School. It's on the
Henry Ford High School where they taught anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I know because of Henry Ford. Yeah. No, but everything's called. And Henry Ford's got all the shit named after him in Detroit. Yeah,
I was stayed at a hotel that was at the fire headquarters in Detroit. This huge fire headquarters right on Learned Street. I think it's Learned or something like that.
I think that's in Detroit. Yeah, I wasn't a suburbanite. Most of the comedians that said they were from Detroit were not. They're from the suburbs. Except for like
Binder.
I'm not sure where he grew up.
He's a Detroit guy.
Yeah. Willie Tyler is from Detroit.
Yeah.
He's a friend. And Johnny Witherspoon's from Detroit, who I used to hang out with.
Yeah.
Who passed so you're away in recently.
Recently, yeah. So you're in Detroit as a kid. Now, was your dad in the auto industry?
Nah. My father was he just was like an upholstery salesman.
Upholstery salesman. And was he like born in the States?
Detroit. He's from Detroit.
Oh, full Detroit.
Yeah, Detroit. Man, my grandparents are from Russia and Romania.
Right. And your mom too?
And my mom's from Detroit.
Yeah. So there you are in what you just did. It's the late 60s.
At 15, I made a plan to leave Detroit. At 15, I had a very horrible childhood.
Why?
Yeah, it was really bad. You know, it was not good. My parents was not. I used to. It was not good. You know,
in
not
which
good.
Way?
In the way that my parents were not that bright. You know, and I was always fighting with them, and just it was not good. You know, it's pretty dysfunctional, like most comedians.
No booze or.
No,
violence?
Not with me.
Yeah.
No, there was no.
No, but I mean with the folks.
No. Oh, no. It was more just, other kinds of abuse.
Emotional.
Emotional and, I won't get into the
Are others. They both gone?
They're both gone. Oh, they're both gone.
You can talk about them.
Oh, I can talk about them. I can talk about. Oh, no. I can talk about, like a lot of comedians, are drug addicts and recovering addicts and all that kind of stuff. And mine's more of a sex addiction. Most people don't like to talk about that. It's like, how many years of recovery you got in alcohol?
Yeah.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah.
What about a sex addict? What the fuck?
Yeah, what is that?
What is that? You got oh, yeah, no whores for how many years?
Yeah.
What the fuck? it's like no one talks about it. No one talks about it.
Well, I just read an interesting little bit about, because I've had arguments with sex workers about, whether or not, porn addiction exists.
Oh, it's a very, I'll guarantee you 1,000% it exists.
Well, I mean, it's framing it that way. The reason why sex industry people don't want to frame it that way is it's easy to exploit it then by the wrong people, by the right wing or religious fanatics that, it's like, they look, that means they look at their work as some, horrible thing, like a drug. So they kind of are defensive about that. But the truth of the matter is dopamine, and how you get it is how you get it. And if you're jacking your dopamine up to get off, then it's an addiction. Period.
Oh, it's a total addiction. I mean, if you go into the, if you, most people have never been into like a recovery room with sex addicts.
Yeah.
And, they, you see these kids, they've been addicted to porn on the internet since they're like 10, 11 years old.
Yeah.
They're so fucked up.
Yeah.
And it's so sad. I mean, they have to stay away from it to get
well, I think
that's out of it.
That's the tricky thing about food and sex addictions is that you have to figure out what your bottom line is. You have to figure out what your line is.
And there's programs that they have, there's
I have the Slaw book.
There's Sex Addicts Anonymous, there's
Sex and Love
Addicts, that's a whole different thing. But they're it's more of a lot of those people are more love addiction as opposed and sex combined, but the sex addiction can't believe I'm talking about this.
And how are you doing with it? All right.
Oh, yeah, I've got like
how many years?
28.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So you ran away from home, basically.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't run away from home. I made a plan.
Yeah.
I mean, who plans at 15?
What was the plan?
At 15, I bought a van and I moved out here and I wanted to be.
What was the plan?
The plan was to become a stand-up comedian.
Based on what? Why'd you decide that? Who was it that made you feel better?
Jonathan Winters was my idol.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Yeah, you kind of did that kind of
thing. Yeah, that kind of stand-up. Yeah, yeah. And I actually got to work with him, too. You know, I got to work with my idol back in 94.
Really?
Working on this TV animated show called Little Dracula, where we got the... It's, you know,
got riffing?
Oh, my God. It was the most fun I ever had with him.
So you drive the car out. You drive your van out.
Yeah.
The VW van?
No. It was a big Ford Econoline.
Econo.
It was a mini home. I bought it myself.
Bought it used?
Yeah, yeah.
And your parents were like, get the fuck out of here? Or like,
no, not at all. I had to leave. It was just so dysfunctional.
Oh, really?
I had to go.
Really?
I had to go.
All right.
It was just so bad. I had to get the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
You know, but back then, you know, and I looked so young, you know, I mean, it was really, you know, well, I remember being on Hollywood Boulevard, and I just turned 18, and I had my ID on, and they were truant officers.
Yeah.
Because it's near Hollywood High School.
Yeah.
I remember they were like, God, all this stuff's coming back to me. They were, let me see your ID, because they were like, you know, getting kids in trouble because they were skipping school.
Right, so, right.
And I just turned 18, and I showed them my card, and
yeah.
I didn't get in trouble because I thought it was from the high school.
Mm.
Yeah, it was weird.
Yeah, I mean, I can't.
And here's how I did the Comedy Store. I went and auditioned,
yeah.
And Mitzi liked me
yeah.
immediately.
Yeah.
And within four times of ever being at the Comedy Store, I was a regular.
How do you know to go there?
How do I know to go there? This is how I discovered the Comedy Store.
All right.
I was working in a furniture store in Detroit.
Yeah.
And
for your dad?
No. Oh. This is a real high-end furniture store.
Yeah.
And I was this horny kid, and they had Playboy magazine.
Yeah.
So I go up into the loft to look at the magazine, you know. And
so you're jerking off upstairs.
No, I didn't jerk off.
All right,
didn't jerk off.
Okay.
But I started reading this article, and it was an article about the Comedy Store. And it said Mitzi Shoor in Playboy.
Yeah.
So I call her. I call her. Yeah. I was a ballsy kid.
Yeah.
You know, I think I was 16.
Call her from Detroit.
Yeah, I call her, and I said, she goes, well, you know, you can come on out, and you can audition. I said, okay. And she was from, her Sammy and her lived in Detroit.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you knew that.
Mitzi, no.
Mitzi and Sammy lived in Detroit. And they actually lived on a street called Littlefield, and I lived on a street called...
After Minneapolis or wherever she was from?
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
That's why she talks like this.
Yeah, yeah.
People don't realize she's not whiny. That's the Wisconsin accent.
Yeah. But it's also a little nasally.
Yeah, it's nasally too, but it's also a Wisconsin.
So she tells you to come out, so was that part of the reason?
Yeah.
You're like, I'm in with Mitzi.
Yeah.
So you get out here, where do you live?
16
or 17.
Oh, 17. I placed an ad. This is really freaky. I'm just nutty. When I look back on it, how do I have the balls to do this so young?
Yeah, I know. I look back on myself too. I don't know how I did it.
I put an ad in the LA Times.
Yeah.
Young man, 18, looking for room for rent, okay? In the LA Times, okay? Oh my God.
Yeah.
And I was really 17.
Yeah.
Or 16 at the time.
Right.
Oh my God, I got letters from all these gay guys, like sending me their pictures and shit.
Yeah.
You can live in my pool house. I didn't know what it was. You know, I mean, I'm from the Midwest. You know, you didn't know what a gay person was even then.
Oh my God.
And like, I'm like all.
And people had to send you actual photographs.
They would send me photos of themselves and stuff. I'm like, I was freaked out.
Yeah.
And then there was one letter from some chick who said you could stay with me and my son in the room and da da da, and I ended up staying there, and I ended up getting scabies from the fucking bed I was sleeping in. And
great
like,
time.
So yeah, oh, it was horrible.
Welcome to L.A.
I have one chapter in my book about scabies,
where
I got scabies from staying in the room. Well, welcome to L.A.
Yeah,
I got scabies.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, it's horrible.
So you go...
Then I stay in this room, okay, and then I go to the I'm living in this room.
Yeah,
the scabies room. It's a scabies room. And then I go to the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
I audition, and Mitzi likes me. She says, come
75.
Back. 74.
74.
Come back next week, she says.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And, so who do you see that first night you're there?
You want to know who started the same exact day as me?
Yeah.
Shirley Hemphill.
Oh, yeah. All right.
She was my buddy.
Yeah.
So it's the day she died, yeah.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
She was great.
Yeah, she was great. She was hilarious.
So you go back the next week
and
you got a spot? And you're working.
I performed. And I only worked about four times. Then she said, you're a regular.
Really? Four times?
4 times. In my whole life.
And no,
I was like a natural, I guess. I don't know. You know,
but you're just doing the voices?
Yeah, doing the voices and the characters from the streets of Detroit.
Yeah.
And it was just, I was wild on stage. I'd say whatever I wanted. And I just looked, because the voices didn't look like they can come out of me.
Yeah.
In fact, I've sounded like I do right now since I was 17 years old. You know, my voice has not changed.
So So when you start working there, how many spots you get in a week? I mean, how?
Oh, afterwards, there was no, they weren't paying you then. There was no.
No, I know,
like,
but.
It's yeah, all... I was working like four nights a week. And actually, I was a doorman, too.
Yeah, me too.
I was a doorman when I was 18, and I got fired for gossiping about some waitress who was screwing this old dude.
Yeah.
It turns out the old dude owned the fucking building.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And Mitzi fired you?
Oh, the guy scared the shit out of me. He came up to me, and I don't want to say his name.
Yeah,
he was a gangster.
He's dead.
He didn't scare me that much at all because I used to work in Detroit.
Sure.
I used to work in this furniture store I worked in.
Yeah,
it was like stone cold mafia.
Yeah,
I mean, and these guys.
Who was the guy?
Frank Senes.
Okay,
he was a mobster.
Yeah,
Jewish mobster.
Who owned?
He owned the whole Ciro's building.
Yeah,
he owned the Comedy Store building.
Huh.
And I was like, I said, you know, and I was talking about this waitress chick. And, you know, because I had a crush on her, and she's like, oh, she's sleeping with that old dude for. And then she's like, Joey's gossiping about me.
Yeah.
And like, and Mitzi found out about it, and she's like, holy fuck. It's this guy. And he goes, I don't like what you're saying about her. And I'm like, holy fuck. Like, he scared me a little bit, but I'm like, you know, this guy's
so
nothing. This guy's not nothing next to this guy's what I grew up with. You know,
right.
I mean, he didn't scare me that bad because I was, there was serious
he's
fucking
reminded
mafiosos.
Me of the
mafiosos I used to deal with.
The Lenny Bruce mafioso voice at the Shelley Berman show.
Hey, what the fuck?
Yeah.
I mean,
so, all right, so you get fired from the door job, but you're still doing spots.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'm still doing spots. Yeah, Mitzi thought it was funny.
Yeah.
You know, she was like, you know, I had a love hate relationship with her anyway.
Who doesn't?
I mean, yeah, she was really mean to me. I mean, really fucking
mean.
Like,
in what way?
You know, I mean, she would just insult me and.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. She was just mean. She was mean.
But who's on the. So, like, at that time, you're friends with Shirley. And, like,
me and Paul Mooney were really good friends.
Right, but this is before the strike, right?
It'll be way before the strike.
So, who's working every night?
Oh.
Like, who are you seeing? Was Barry Levinson there? Craig T. Nelson?
No, you know, those guys were. They stopped. They stopped working. I think I used to see their pictures there.
Yeah.
I never really watched. Boy, you have a really good memory.
I lived at the place for almost a year, and we used to look at the pictures and wonder how everybody fit in.
No, I never saw those guys.
It was a little before you.
You know
huh?
who was there?
But Sammy was out.
Sammy was definitely out.
Okay.
Who was also there was like Charlie Fleischer was there.
Right.
Mooney was there
yeah.
all the time. Me and him used to work for years to 1, 2 in the morning. I'd go on like at 1:30.
Yeah.
He'd close the show for do like an hour at the end.
And so, but Pryor was coming around then too, right?
Pryor was definitely, Pryor was there like 75 and on.
Yeah.
I watched him do hundreds of shows.
And so, but when did... But he was sort of the first major star that, like, kind of the place, you know, made its living.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the guy that really made that place was Jimmy Walker.
Yeah.
You know, he was a big star, and he put his name on the marquee, and we filmed every night.
Yeah.
People don't know that. If it wasn't for him,
I know that. He'll tell you that.
Yeah, he'll tell you that. But it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
But Letterman and Leno were hanging around?
Oh, yeah. Leno and Letterman were there. Yeah. Leno was great. Jay Leno could do 90 minutes in a clip and make it look like it was the easiest thing in the world. He's a great stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
He was, like, the best.
Letterman's there.
Oh, yeah. David was there. He was, like, a guy from Indianapolis. I saw him a couple years ago at Johnny Witherspoon's memorial.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's still a good guy.
He's gotten very sweet, yeah. I think, in his old age. I don't know him as a young man, but I've done his show, and he's got a big heart these days.
Yeah. David's I've always liked David, you know.
So who are your friends? Shirley and Mooney and who else?
Oh, God. Who else?
Or did you, you were living at the place. You were there all the time.
I hung out with, who else did I hang out with back then? I hung out with Johnny Witherspoon a lot.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's like my life from like when I was a kid in Detroit was the same. I hang out with mostly the black comedians.
Yeah.
You know, it was weird. You know.
You grew up hanging out with mostly black people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
From the age of up to 11, I only had black friends. And then I moved into a white neighborhood and it was the worst. I was bullied and it was like the worst thing.
Oh, really?
People thought it was like, you know, it was really funny because like when I mentioned my old life to like people and I say, well, I was like the only white kid in my fifth grade English class.
Yeah.
And they go, they'd whisper me, weren't you scared?
Yeah.
And I'm like, do you mean wasn't I scared? That's all I knew.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
You know, and then when I moved into the white neighborhood because I was a tiny kid,
yeah.
White kids beat the shit out of me.
Yeah.
It was like in the black neighborhoods, I was like fun. I was cool to hang out with. I was a cute little kid, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, you were like a novelty, a mascot.
I was fun.
Yeah.
I was fun, you know, to hang out with.
So when you get out here, so you're doing comedy. So what's the plan? I mean, you know, you're getting spots. So what are you going on auditions?
Oh,
you
trying to- yeah. I was going on auditions. I was, when I was.
Alan Bursky. What about Bursky?
What about him?
He was around, right?
Yeah, he was around. A little bit. Freddie Prinze, I didn't know. Just to say hello. I saw him there.
Oh, yeah?
I would see him there. I'd see all these guys.
Yeah.
You know? But when I was 18, I was... Actually, today is his 34th year of his death. My mentor, Dawes Butler. Dawes Butler was the voice of Huckleberry Hound, Yogi Bear, Quick Draw McGraw, Snagglepuss, Jinx, Pixie, Augie Doggie, Captain Crunch, Wally the Gator, Lippy. He saw me at 18 at the Comedy Store.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
He was hanging around. He wasn't a comic.
No. But get this. My roommate at that time, I moved into this other house and I had a roommate.
Out of the Scabies house.
Out of the Scabies house. Yeah. And then I got a roommate. And one of the roommates was writing for some radio show, and Dawes was on the radio show, and he goes, "You got to meet my roommate Joey. He's a stand-up comedian. Does all these voices and characters and stuff." And it turns out Dawes had started as a stand-up comic in Ohio, doing voices and characters, and you know, all that stuff. So he comes to the Comedy Store, and it's like a, it used to be Monday night potluck.
So he started doing his voices on stage.
So he comes to the Comedy Store, sees my act, likes me. And I go, "Hey, Mitzi, Dawes Butler is here," and I go, "Dawes, you want to go on stage?" And I go, says, "Mitzi, Dawes Butler, who's that?" I go, "He's Yogi Bear, Huckleberry Hound, Quick Draw, Snagglepuss. Tell the MC to put him on next."
Yeah.
So he goes on, and the place goes, and he hasn't been on stage in front of a live audience in God knows how long, Mark.
Yeah.
So he's going, he's doing all the characters. The audience is, how often do you get to see Huckleberry Hound and Yogi Bear and Quick and he's doing all these characters on stage.
And they're his.
It's him. And he's only like 5 feet tall.
Yeah. Is it with you short guys and the voices?
Yeah, he's short guys and the voices. I'm serious. No. Yeah,
Big voice.
Paul Frees was who's like the voice of all the Haunted Mansion and all that stuff.
Yeah.
He was only like 5'2".
Huh.
A big, deep voice.
Yeah,
You know, and so he's going nuts.
He
and,
kills?
And you're only supposed to do 5 minutes. He's on like 40 minutes. Oh. And the crowd's going nuts. And then the black dude yells out, "Do Bugs Bunny, motherfucker." And he goes, "And then, that's not me. And then it's like, get him off. Then they finally got him off. And then he went on the second night. And I remember, he went on. He came back this next week and did it again.
Killed?
Killed. But
no Mel Blanc voices.
No Mel Blanc voices. But it was pretty funny when the guy yelled out, "Do Bugs Bunny." Because they were the two most famous voiceover people in the world.
Him and Mel.
So, him and Mel. So Dawes asks me to be his protege.
Oh, yeah.
And just like that.
How does that how did that work? What's that relationship? How do you be a protege? You're hired.
Hired. You just go to his. He had a little house in Beverly Hills. And he had a garage like this, where he had class, and I would just study with him privately.
Oh, he had a class.
Yeah, he taught. He taught. Yeah, he was even on his tombstone. It says mentor.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, mentor. Yeah.
So you start doing that, and you're 19 or 18.
18.
And what are you learning as a voice?
Well, you know
what?
Here's what he did for me.
Yeah.
You know, they talk about because I had a very good ear. I could do any type of accent. Yeah. You know, dialect and all that kind of stuff. He gave me confidence.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you don't you're that young. You're insecure. You know, he gave me confidence. Dogs.
Yeah.
And he teach me some accent, but basically it was an acting class.
Yeah.
Basically, it was about characters.
Yeah.
It was an acting class. It was my first acting class, and I loved it.
Yeah.
And he was great. And I really didn't appreciate it back then. You know, when you're young and cocky.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really appreciate what you have. You know, it's like.
But you're a big fan of his.
I mean, God. I mean, he would just.
So you're doing comedy, but you still like if you were still doing comedy in like the 80s when I got there. I mean, you were doing comedy. So did you go out on the road?
Yeah, I did do the road a little bit. I did do the.
But there was no real comedy clubs then. So would you open for musical acts?
I did do some of that, and I did God, what is that? You know, I'd have to look up in my, you know, my mind's going crazy. Yeah, I did open for musical acts, Jan and Dean and Badfinger. And
you opened for Badfinger?
Yeah, once. Yeah?
Yeah.
And, how I opened those? For Oingo Boingo once.
Oingo Boingo, that's a little later than
Jan and Dean. Yeah, that was a little later. Yeah, that was some stadium somewhere. I can't remember. You know, my mind's a
sieve. That's a hard gig, right?
Gig. All those gigs are hard, you know, opening up for those kind of guys.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, well, one story, I didn't open for him, but one time Joe Cocker came to see me.
Sure.
At the Comedy Store. I was dating this girl who was Joe Cocker's babysitter.
Uh-huh.
And Joe Cocker comes to see me.
Yeah.
And he likes me.
Yeah.
So, and he was the most egoless guy I've ever seen in my life.
He was the nicest.
And he goes, after he sees my act, he goes, let's go. Come on, Joey, let's go. And he takes me like this. And, he takes me to all these Hollywood parties.
Yeah.
And he goes, and he's like, and he's and makes me out to be the star. I'm like 19.
Yeah.
He makes me out to be the star. Joe Cocker.
Yeah.
And he's like taking me all these parties. And he goes, you got to see Joey. He's great. He's fucking great. And he's like, we're at this party, and we're about 20 minutes. Goes, let's get the fuck out of here. I go, what's going on? He goes, the Scientologists, I don't like it. Let's go. He didn't want to be around Scientologists.
Yeah. That's when that was kind of new, too.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And then we went to a party at his house.
Yeah.
And they're all doing coke and all this stuff. And I didn't do anything.
Nothing?
I didn't do drugs at all.
Yeah, ever.
I didn't like drugs. Yeah. It's like 3 a.m. And he was so nice. Everybody's doing all this coke and everything. And like, so I'm like sitting there and I said, Joe, I'm going to go. He goes, no, sit down. He kicks everybody out of the bathroom with me, and he's all loaded out of his fucking mind. And he goes, he wants to play me this cassette tape. In the bathroom. Out of his fucking mind.
Yeah.
Out of this new album.
Yeah.
And he hits the play button, and it's like from that Luxury You Can Afford album, I think, or something. Uh-huh. It's some new album from the 70s or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And I go, sounds good. Sounds like shit. Is what he goes, sounds like shit. I go, just shut more. Yeah, I don't want to say he just had done other drugs. I thought it sounded good. And he said, but he was the nicest guy. He didn't want me to leave.
Yeah.
And I had to leave. It was like
on himself.
Yeah, it was very hard on himself. But it was Joe Cocker.
It's wild, man.
I mean, isn't that wild?
Yeah,
I mean,
you're like 18, 19 years old.
Yeah, 19 years old. And he's the nicest guy. I mean, it was like he was just a sweetheart.
So where does the career go? Like, how do you stay? Like, you're 19, you're doing the voices, you're doing this.
Well,
and that,
I did voiceover work, you know.
Starting then?
Yeah, around 1920. You know, I started doing stuff like Smurfs. In the early 80s and stuff like that. Yeah, I was a Smurf for about a year.
A year, that's pretty good.
Yeah, and just character voices and things like that, animation. Yeah.
I remember, like, you didn't you have one of those composite headshots?
Different characters.
There's
and
like
stuff.
A big lollipop one, a guy holding a big lollipop with a little hat on, like a little kid.
Yeah. Oh my God, you have a great memory, Mark. And I don't even remember half the shit I did.
Yeah, did you do some weird kid character?
Yeah, I did a little kid character. Yeah, a little boy character that it was.
Who was that guy?
There was a little boy character, and that ended up being the voice of one of the Smurfs. You know.
Was it?
It was a voice like this. His name was Natural Smurf. He talked like that, okay?
Yeah.
You know, so man, my voices would go from little tiny voices to, you know, I did Space Jam back in the 90s.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I was the voice of, what do you call, Bang the Monstar. And his voice was like, you're all washed up, Baldy. You know, that was like, you know, and that was Patrick Ewing. I was playing Patrick Ewing as a giant goon.
Yeah.
You know, in Space Jam.
Yeah. So what was your first big break then with the voices?
I guess this
was the Smurfs.
Smurfs, yeah.
And did you get that? Who'd you get that through? Yeah, an agent.
Yeah, I had an agent. Yeah, agent and all that kind of stuff. And
so, like, how does that unfold for you? If this is such a big part of your life, I mean, you're doing like you never stopped doing comedy. When did you stop? Like, when did you feel like you stopped doing comedy?
I mean, stopped doing stand up.
Yeah.
Well, I got bored with it back in the late 90s, and I started doing, I did a one-man show for a while.
You did?
Yeah.
Was that an honest one or just character-driven?
No, it was called In the Hood with Mrs. Aronovitz, and it was about it was one man. I didn't do, I, you know, a lot of people's comedians go, I'm doing a one man show. What they do is stand up in the theater.
Yeah.
The same act they've been doing forever.
Yeah.
And that's a one man show.
Right.
What this was an actual play that I wrote.
Yeah.
You know, because I've been writing for a very long time.
Yeah.
And it was about a woman, an old Jewish woman who had an apartment house, and her real estate developer's son tried to screw out of the building and tear it down and pull the parking lot. All the tenants get together and rally around the building back for her. So I played like 9 different characters.
Oh, wow. How'd that go over?
It was pretty good.
You know, where'd you do it?
Pretty good reviews. I did it in L.A. at a couple places, and I did it in a couple places in New York.
Well, what happened with so you're at the store still. So where were you during the strike?
I was there performing. Yeah. I didn't cross the line.
Yeah.
I didn't cross the line at all. No. No.
So,
the strike was wild.
Yeah. How'd that unfold? I've heard a couple points of view on it. Was that 75 or 76?
Something like that. You know.
Everybody's just doing work for nothing.
Everybody's working for free.
Yeah.
And Mitzi, I remember this fact, and it kind of freaked me out because it was a lot of money. She spent like $500,000 not to let anybody. During the strike, supposedly.
Not to let anyone
work. Not to have to pay anyone.
Oh, okay. Really?
Ridiculous amounts of money.
How'd that work? What do you mean?
I don't know. I remember a figure that I had heard.
So there were people that were, you know, striking to get some sort of wage.
Right.
For performing. And then there were people that crossed the line, a few people.
Yeah. Quite a few people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did they end up getting fucked?
I didn't pay too much attention to it. There are more people that were into that than I was. I didn't want to deal with all the politics and all that crap.
So you didn't work?
You know, no, I didn't. Mm. I didn't. I just, you know, collected unemployment or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, but you don't, like, you. But it did resolve itself eventually.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's more guys that know about the whole history of that. Like, Tom Dreesen knows the whole history of that.
Yeah, I talked to him about it.
Yeah.
But you're just one of the guys, like, I'm just going to avoid the place till they get this settled.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to deal with all that. Guys were fucking nuts.
They were?
Yeah, and was fighting and screaming at each other on the line and all that.
The comics.
Comics. They were, like, angry.
Yeah.
You know, and just going nuts at each other.
Really?
Yeah.
Like who?
I don't know. He wants to hear all the dirt.
Well, no, but I mean, it's like 1 million years old. It doesn't really matter. I mean, I mean, I've talked to Dreesen about it. I've talked to Leno about it.
To Leno about it? Oh, yeah. Ollie Joe Prater. Remember him?
Dead. Sure.
Yeah, he's dead.
But he crossed the line?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He crossed the line and people were like going ape shit on his ass.
So he was on Team Mitzi.
He was on Team Mitzi for a long time. And Mitzi helped him out go to rehab a couple times.
Oh, I know. I was a doorman, he lived up in that house that she had at the top of the parking lot there. You know, he'd hobble around with his gout. And he's like he was this notorious joke thief that was,
people didn't like him for doing that at all. And, Ollie had a lot of demons, you know. I mean,
sure.
By
the time I saw him, he looked like he was going to die. He must have weighed 200-300 pounds.
Well, you want to know why? He was like that too. He from Jackson, Michigan, which is like a shithole. People don't know this story. Ollie, when I met him, he was driving a meat truck. Yeah. That's what he did for a living.
Yeah.
And he bring back he gave me a box of Delmonico steaks.
Yeah.
Because he would just take them off the truck and give them to me. It's a very tragic story. He was driving a truck and one of the wheels fell off and he got in a car accident and he hit a car and 2 kids were killed, little boys.
Uh-huh.
And he killed 2 kids.
Yeah. Terrible.
And that ruined him. That
forever.
It ruined him forever. That's why he got high a lot and gained weight and all that stuff. And
never could process it. Even though it was an accident.
It was an accident, yeah. And that was one reason that he was the way he was.
Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Most people don't know that story.
Yeah,
I mean,
most people don't know him.
They don't know him at a period. Right, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. But that was a sad thing for the guy. You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know? So when the strike finally resolves itself, you start working again.
Yeah, you started going on, and you got you paid your little $25 or whatever, and
because you were doing the main room a lot when I was the doorman.
I did the main room, and
you get a little piece of the door.
Yeah, you got a piece of the door, and you could make good money.
So when did this addiction start to reveal itself
for me?
Yeah,
that revealed itself for me in the '94.
Oh, 94 was when you got hip to it, or
not when I got into recovery.
When you got into recovery. Oh, so you didn't know you were doing anything wrong. How did your life get out of control? What was the process?
Oh,
so
fuck you, me.
What?
I mean, it was like process. I don't. Do I really want to hear? I should talk about this shit.
Don't you talk about it?
Yeah, I do. And yeah, not that much, but yeah.
I mean, it seems to be part of your story.
It is part of my story. Yeah, man. Yeah. You know,
because you're in Hollywood. You're 19, 20 years old.
Yeah, you're cruising for whores. And, yeah. You know, I'm there everywhere.
That's what you were doing on Sunset Strip.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just like an alcoholics, you know, like, where do I get my next drink?
Oh, yeah.
Where do I get my next hit of coke?
Yeah.
Where do I get my next hooker?
Yeah. So you're a hooker guy.
Yeah, I was.
And that went on.
Oh, but my wife's going to really like hearing this.
Oh, but she knows.
Yeah, she knows.
But but it's interesting because I don't know that I've talked to too many sort of sex addicts that can frame it in a way that, you know, that is a recovery story. You know, you don't, like, I don't know that people know. Look, everyone knows, you know, there's gambling addicts, you know, Mitchell Walter, you knew him.
Oh, God.
What?
You know what's wrong? What I have to say, because when you talk to comedians,
yeah.
I have to, I like to be a positive person, you know, but when you start talking about these people, you know, it can get you into this negative mode.
Oh, yeah?
You know, yeah. It's like, fuck that guy. Yeah. That guy's a fucking asshole.
I know that mode well.
You know, comedians, when you get around and you start talking about people from the past, it's like, that guy's a dick.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, because, like, comedians are like some of the most negative people you could ever meet.
Uh-huh.
You know, and they get up on stage and they're saying all this negative, depressing shit.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, but it's like, yeah, you know. Yeah. In fact, Mitchell Walters was the last guy that Steve Lebeckin saw before he died.
Come on.
Yes, he is.
How do you know that?
I know it for a fact.
Why? Okay.
Because he said, hey, how's it going? And he saw him in the lobby of the Continental Hyatt House when he was going up. I said, well, shit, I'd jump too if I had to see with that son of a bitch. Before.
And now they're both gone. I didn't know him that well. I just knew that, you know, I knew that.
Oh, I knew him.
Yeah.
He was a gambling addict and just a.
Yeah.
He used to come over to my house and heck, they had a card game once and try to cheat people. He'd borrow money from waitresses. He was a lowlife.
Yeah.
Never pay him back.
Yeah.
Waitresses aren't making any money.
Yeah.
You know, he just horrible shit.
Yeah. Do you remember when Sam showed up?
Sam, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How was that for you?
You know, he grew on me. You know, Sam, you know, at first I was like, what the fuck? This guy's just screaming the shit out. And, you know, it's like, who's, you know, when you have to scream your punchlines, I mean, it's like, you know, come on.
Yeah.
You know, and after a while, I thought it was funny.
Yeah.
You know, but.
Was he nice to you?
When he wasn't high.
Yeah, right.
When he was high, he was not a nice person.
Yeah. What about Dice?
He's all right.
Yeah.
Andrew Silverstein. Yeah.
But how about Damon Wayans? I remember seeing him when he was a kid over there. You guys get along all right?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Mark wants all the dirt.
No, I don't want any dirt. I mean, the weird thing about this particular dirt is it's so small.
It's so small, no one knows, yeah.
Exactly. So, like, it's always fascinates me when I talk to guys from the store because, like, you know, like, I have my experience there. And I've talked to all the old guys, you know, about it.
Yeah.
But, and Jimmy Walker is very lucid about, you know, that management company he had and, you know, working with the Letterman and Leno and writing for those. Like, you know, there's a whole world there that a few people care about. But it's just sort of interesting to me from my own experience.
Sure.
To know what these guys were like back then, because I missed a lot of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I worked with these guys. You know?
Yeah. You worked with them all the time.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Damon was pretty funny. I mean, we actually, Mitzi made us a comedy team for about 6 weeks.
Really?
Yeah.
She was kind of weird like that. So like
Mitzi would do weird shit. Like, you know, comedians worshipped her.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they'd come from around the country.
Well, they,
from Chicago,
they,
New York.
They wanted the opportunity.
They wanted to be on the
They were scared of her like you are of a leader of
company. They were scared of her. I just thought she was a nut job.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I'd known her since I was like 17 years old. She was just a wacky lady. She'd be in the booth.
Yeah.
You know, and she'd hey,
yeah.
Get him off, turn the light. Yeah. Nut job.
Uh-huh.
You know, and she had all this power.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know. And
she says, Damon, you and
so
Damon.
So she made us a comedy team. We would do sketches. We were called Chocolate Moose, and we did it for like 6 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And she gave us prime time spots for six.
Were you getting laughs?
Yeah, big laughs. You know, it's like we were doing sketch comedy.
Yeah.
And, you know, then we just said, you know.
In the main room?
Main room, little, whatever. And I'm like, all right, that's it. You know,
yeah.
You know. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know.
It didn't stick.
You know, we said, we don't want to do this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, okay, we're done.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so we're
interesting.
We're, yeah.
But like, you know, I do notice that you brought a paper.
I was talking about this film that I have been trying to get made. It's called Pieces of Strange.
Well, yeah, yeah.
It's about a sex addiction. It's in the vein of Leaving Las Vegas, except the drug of choice is
prostitutes.
Sex addiction, and yeah. It's based on my old life, but it's about a guy who's an auto dealer. He has a used auto dealership in Las Vegas, and he's trying to maintain a normal life.
Yeah,
wife and kids,
uh-huh.
And he's a sex addict. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds pretty menacing.
Yeah, so we're trying to raise like $1.4 million for it.
That's not bad.
Yeah, it's pretty cheap.
So like going back to that, so like you're 20, 21 years old and you're just living the life and you think like, well, this is Hollywood, this is what we do, this is the 70s, and you're just running around, you know, getting hookers and stuff.
Yeah, I had girlfriends and stuff, you know, too, you know.
Yeah, yeah, but so that was the double life element.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's really where, because like, you know, in the language of recovery, you know, what determines whether you have a problem or not is when your life becomes unmanageable.
Exactly.
So like, in not having that, you know, not being a hooker guy and not having that particular addiction in that way, you know, I've experienced my share of porn and sort of love addiction, but how does that start to spiral?
Okay, it spiraled it just gets worse and worse. You know, you start, you know, you're on the streets and you're cruising for hours. Or you're,
oh, really? Yeah, okay.
Or you're, you know, masturbating yourself into a fucking frenzy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and
sure.
you're pornography,
yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, there's no internet then, and
yeah.
You know,
so you got to go to the stores and
videotapes, and yeah. You know, you're sitting there looking at fucking videos for hours, and
yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
And you can't stop, and it's really a very depressing life.
Yeah,
and now it's like these people are on the internet for like fucking 17 hours.
No,
a
I know,
day.
I know a guy that was deep in, and yeah, just they can't get out of the
loop. It's really horrible. I mean,
yeah.
it's very depressing. It's very, and it's like, what the fuck is wrong with me?
Yeah,
you know, you just sit there and you go, this is not the life I signed up for. You know,
well,
I mean,
it's interesting when things get away from you, like in terms of like that particular one. You know, where you do, like, I imagine that, you know, if you're trying to have regular relationships, but you're compelled towards, you know, hookers and porn,
yeah.
That there's, that, yeah, how many times did you have to have that conversation with a regular person who is wanting to have a relationship with you?
You don't have that conversation.
Because you can't explain it. They just leave.
No, yeah. Or if you know, I was dating one girl once, and I showed her something that I had, a magazine. She fucking freaked out, and they want to have nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, and it's like, okay, then you're going to yourself, oh, this is not, I'm not sane.
Yeah, right.
There's
right.
Something wrong with me.
So we finally hit the wall in 94?
Yeah, and then I was like, you
what
know.
What was your bottom? What made
oh,
you
I'm
go
not
there?
Talking about that.
Okay.
What was my bottom? What are you, my fucking therapist?
Sure.
No, actually, I had a conversation with somebody, a comedian, and they were talking about I think it was SLA.
Yeah, yeah.
And I go, what is that? Slap? I go, does that mean you slap your meat? What the fuck? Like,
yeah.
Like, well, you're talking about sex and love.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was slap.
Yeah,
goes,
yeah.
No,
yeah.
It's sex and love addicts.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was slap.
He's trying to help
me
out. Yeah.
And so I went out to a meeting of that Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous.
Yeah.
I go, and then I turned to some guy, I go, I thought this was one for sex addiction. Oh, no, nah, man, you don't want this. You want SAA, Sex Addicts Anonymous.
Oh, yeah.
So I go, okay, I'm getting the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
I barely lasted in that one meeting. So I found a Sex Addicts Anonymous meeting, and I went in, and I'm like, okay, I'm home.
So you went and found a room full of seven guys who were like,
No, but they're not like that. They look like, you know, you always think that it's like, you're going to look at, you're going to go see some guy like
that. Yeah.
I mean, there are a couple guys that look like that,
but
the most of them just look like your next door neighbor.
Sure,
that
sure.
look like, you know, whoever.
Sure. So were you able to, so you figured out what you're sort of like, you know, you were able to put figure out your bottom line around sex and not act out. And
they have like a program, of what you stay away from. Yeah, and
you're doing it.
Yeah.
And did it a long time.
You did a long
time. And you're able to find a relationship.
Yeah, I've been married almost 20 years.
Oh, that's great. You have kids?
No kids.
But you worked it out, huh?
Yeah.
And through that program, though, were you able to sort of track, you know, the evolution of why you ended up there?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
You know, you realize, you know, it's all from childhood. Most people that have that addiction have some sort of, not all, but a lot of them have some sort of sexual abuse type situation going on.
Yeah, sure.
In most of the, you know, in porn and all that stuff, you know, I remember there used to be these porn stars that would come to the Comedy Store all the time.
Yeah, Christy Canyon. What was the other one?
Amber Lynn used to
Amber
come.
Amber Lynn, right.
I remember meeting them and stuff and all, talking to them and everything.
Ron Jeremy was around.
Oh, I used to talk. Oh, God. He's in jail now.
I know. Yeah.
He's a strange guy. I remember he used to have me talk to these...
Kind of a bad guy, I guess.
Yeah. You know, I got stories about him. But anyway, he used to have these girls come on, and I used to, like, you know, oh, my God, porn stars.
Yeah.
You know, I would talk to them, and after, you know, like, they're hot looking and everything.
Yeah.
And after I got through talking to him, he'd be like, oh, my God, I don't want to do anything with them. They're just, they were, like, so depressing and messed up. I remember driving one girl home to her, like, her, she was staying at a hotel in on Sepulveda Boulevard. I gave her a ride home. She was, like, so depressed. She was so sweet, though. She was gorgeous.
Yeah.
But she was so sweet. She said she only did scenes with women for the money. With guys for the money. And,
yeah.
It was just so sad, you know.
Yeah, they're sad people.
They're sad. They were all sexually abused. Every single one of them.
So I guess at some point the reason you start to get sober is you kind of like it's that's sort of like an empathetic breakthrough to not objectify somebody and understand the tragedy of it all.
Yeah, you understand that you don't want to contribute to that abuse because every one of them out there is abused. I mean, you think people it's their goal in life to be on the street, you know, sucking off guys in cars.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, oh, it's my goal in life.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like you know, I mean, it is all self-absorbed stuff. You know.
So are you working through all this too, right? I mean, you're living this life, but you're doing a lot of voice work and you're doing all this
stuff. I'm still able,
making a living.
Yeah, making a living and doing all that shit and boy, I can't believe I'm talking to you about this, Mark.
Well, I mean, it sort of happens. We talk about recovery a lot on this. It comes up.
Yeah.
So do you ever do any live performing anymore?
You know, I haven't, the live performing I've been doing lately is at people's memorials.
Oh,
You know, speaking at the memorials and stuff.
Who have you done? People we know?
Mooney. I did a couple of Mooneys.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Mooneys. I spoke at his. He had one at the Laugh Factory and everything, but it's a huge thing at the Roosevelt Hotel that they had me speak at because I was one of his oldest friends.
Really? How was that for you?
That was really great. You know, because at least I was one of the people that knew him very well.
Yeah.
You know.
And all through his life?
The last 10 or more years, we didn't have much communication.
Yeah.
But the earlier years, I was one of like, you know, it's really weird with Paul because Paul, he would do all that racist stuff on stage, you know, about the white man. It was all an act.
Yeah.
You know, I told him at the Laugh Factory, I go, this is bullshit. I go, you know, you guys are all thinking, I go, Paul lived in white neighborhoods.
Yeah.
I never saw one black person at his house. It was all, you know, and he's befriending me. I had no idea how old he was. I mean, his kids, you know, were like.
The Mooney twins?
Yeah, they're like a year younger than me. You know, and like, and I did not know how old Paul was.
Yeah.
And he just liked me. He was a great guy, and he always kept his word. He put me on the Richard Pryor show.
Yeah, what? Now, tell me about that show. Like, how did that happen?
Okay, the Richard Pryor show, that's 1977. You know, it was only four episodes.
Yeah.
And, you know, Paul, this has never happened in the history of network television.
Mm-hmm.
No one on that cast had to audition. No one.
Yeah.
It was just given the part. They knew you could do it.
And they pulled them all from the Comedy Store.
Yep.
It was you, Bernhard, Robin
Williams, with Johnny Witherspoon.
Yeah.
Tim Reed.
Yeah, Tim Reed.
Who else? You'd have to look it up on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah, a lot of guys. Oh, Vic Dunlap.
Oh, yeah, Vic Dunlap.
Who
right.
passed away.
Yeah.
He was a sweet guy.
Yeah.
Known him since I was 18.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those guys. Yeah, and we didn't have to audition. They just put me in a couple of sketches and you know, hanging out.
And who was writing? Paul and...
Paul and Pryor. And, yeah. I don't know who else was other writers were.
Yeah.
And you know, but it was a lot of fun. It was a good learning experience. And Paul would write a sketch for me, or you know,
yeah,
a white guy who wants to be black.
Yeah,
you know, they put me in that. That's, you know,
that was your part over
you know,
and over.
One
again.
of the parts.
That's funny.
Little sketch in you know, and then I remember I did one sketch and there was like I ad lib something and I got a huge laugh and it was cut out.
Oh.
That's happened to me a few times in stuff where I got a huge laugh right.
Was that
a or I upstaged somebody and it'd be gone.
Right. Was that at CBS? Where was it?
NBC.
At NBC.
Yeah.
And because I remember watching it pretty recently, because there's a bunch of stuff of Richard showing up at the show, right? Yeah. Isn't there like bits and pieces where like
it's been so long since I've seen that.
Oh,
stuff.
Oh. But it must have been, that was the first big TV show, right?
Yeah. The first thing I did. Yeah, yeah.
And Paul, like, what about that roast that there?
Oh, that roast was insane. I didn't get to be in that. I didn't get to be.
That
in
seemed
that.
Like crazy.
I just had small little sketches, like two or three.
Right, because that was the roast where...
The roast was fucking insane.
It's like, it's hard to find. It was not television.
No! I mean, because they were all talking about him real sweet, and then he gets up there and rips everybody a new
Paul.
Fucking... No.
Richard.
Richard rips everybody a new fucking asshole.
Yeah.
And was like, it was unfucking believable. Pryor was funny. Richard was just as funny offstage as he was on.
Sure.
I mean, just talking to him.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd make you laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he would do shit. I remember one time we were in the hallway of the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
And he starts telling this story about this white guy that was performing.
Yeah.
God, this is all coming back to me. The people don't know these. Okay. We're standing in the hallway at the back of the Comedy Store there. And
by the phone?
By the phone.
Yeah.
Okay. And Richard's telling us this story. Me, I'm standing there. I think Mooney's there.
Yeah.
And he starts telling us this story about some white guy who was auditioning at the Apollo Theater playing guitar.
Yeah.
Some redneck.
Yeah.
And going, ding, 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 my guitar, and there. And he said they didn't like him. They're booing him. And they had the microphone. He said it went down into the floor to get him off.
Yeah.
And he starts pretending he's the guy. And he's singing all the way down to the floor with the microphone. Yeah. And just the way he did it, it was so fucking funny. And he was like
acting it out.
Yeah. And it would just make me laugh so hard. He just made me laugh. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he's great.
You know, just hanging
out. Yeah.
But you know, I wasn't one of the guys that got to go to his house or anything, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a house he had in Northrop, but you know, he was the opposite of Paul. Paul had mostly white friends. Richard, I don't really think hung out with too many white dudes.
White dudes,
chicks, but not white dudes.
Uh huh. But you and Paul, like, you know, Paul was always interesting. You know, he had an act, but he seemed like a different kind of guy offstage. I can only imagine what he would have been personally.
He's
very sweet.
He
guy,
would scare. He did it on purpose.
I know. I saw it happen. That's
he would scare white guys on purpose.
Yeah.
And I knew this from the beginning. So, like, people would say, Joe, you hang out with Mooney? I'm like, yeah. You know, because, you know, he knew I was a real guy from Detroit. You know, he's not, I'm not like, he wouldn't have hung out with me if I was, you know.
Yeah.
You know? So, here's a story. I actually told this at the Laugh Factory during the thing. For one of the first gigs I ever had, paying gigs as a stand-up, I was like, this is before the Richard Pryor show.
Yeah.
Paul, there was no clubs to play.
Right.
So Paul was from the Bay Area.
Yeah.
You know, and he always pretended like I'm from the ghetto and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So he got these little one-nighters.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
And the little
He'd
one-
He'd book them out?
No. He
They'd
booked
hire
himself.
Him.
No, he booked it for me and him.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
That he found up in the Bay Area.
Sure.
So we drive up. He had this old Jaguar that fucking sucked up oil every fucking.
I remember the Cadillac.
Yeah.
And he used to drive Mitzi's Cadillac. That one with the Comedy Store logo on it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. So we go up there to the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And I stay at his mom's house. We stayed at his mom's house.
And
his mom's house. A nicer neighborhood than I ever lived in.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, he pretended he was like from the ghetto or something. He's like, it was like, you know, Leave It to Beaver home.
Yeah.
You know, in like Presidio Heights or some shit.
Yeah.
It was like a really nice neighborhood.
Yeah.
He's like, and his mom looked young as him.
Yeah.
You know, young, like his sister.
Yeah.
And so we go to these gigs and there's these, comedian, and there was this one comedian. I'm not going to say his name because I don't like him, but he's still an asshole. And he's like, he was just starting out, and he's like a real cocky fuck.
Yeah.
And Mooney just grabs him and goes, "No, no, no! You introduce me like this, brother. No, 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 no! And don't say anything. Don't deviate from what I tell you." And he goes, "Okay, yes, yes, Mr. Mooney, yes, yeah. Mr. Mooney." Yeah. And then he walks away, and Paul goes, "Joey, did I scare him?" Because like just like that,
yeah.
Because he said, and he was always doing that because he didn't like the guy. The guy was a dick.
Yeah,
and
he's still a dick.
He's still a dick.
Uh-huh.
And we went and did these little gigs, and it was a lot of fun. And I don't even remember what I got paid. And on the way back, we went to his grandmother's house, and she made us fried chicken. Who she lived like in Oakland. She made us a big bag of fried chicken, she put it in a paper bag, and we're eating the fried chicken on the freeway and throwing the bones out the window on the way back. And he goes, "Joey, give me that bag. Don't eat all that chicken, Joey." And like it was pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that he was able to I guess at that point, learning how to be scary. Somehow.
Yeah, well, he was doing that, but it was just an intimidation thing, and he would laugh about it. But those guys were, they just couldn't spot it. They just were intimidated by.
Well, that was it. Became his tone. His comedic tone was really that.
Well, I mean, he would do the white man black guy thing, he was married to a white lady. He had one white wife.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what his private life
is. I know all about it.
It seems to be, a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was married several times and he had a bunch of different kids.
Sure.
A bunch of kids and,
And what about Robin? Did you have a relationship with Robin?
Yeah, well, Robin, I stayed away from the guy. He used to steal material.
Yeah.
He stole my material. He did he stole one of my bits and did it on the Mork and Mindy pilot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was on the pilot.
Wow.
And I got really pissed.
Yeah.
And he gave me a check for $300, and I'll never forget. And he goes, "Don't cash it till Tuesday." And I was really fucking angry at the guy.
Wow.
Really angry at the guy.
Did you guys get into a big fight?
Well, I'm not physical. I'm not a big guy.
No, I know, but.
No, I just didn't, it was the fact,
he did that a lot then.
He stole from a lot of people.
Yeah. And he just give people checks and think that was
but,
okay.
But the thing is, he only stole from people that he could get it away from. You didn't see him stealing from George Carlin
You're saying people that no one knew.
No one knew or people that needed money.
Yeah.
And some people pay their rent just from him stealing their jokes. But the whole thing is, and I talk about this in the book, he would steal jokes. He would steal your joke, do it on the Tonight Show, then you do your joke, and people think you stole from Robin Williams.
Right.
That's like, Stephen King doing, comedians, the worst thing you can do to a comedian, as you know, is steal your material.
Yeah. Yeah, especially when the world was that small, where it's like, there were three TV shows.
Right.
So, people knew. Millions of people were watching The Tonight Show.
Right. And there's your joke on a Tonight Show.
And then you do it in a club.
And they go, you stole Robin Williams' material. No, fuck you. He stole my shit.
Did he ever make it right with you?
He just gave me a check.
Oh, so that was
it. And that was it.
Yeah.
And then I just, stayed away from the guy.
After all this is the one-man show, now you got these books. Tell me about My Life with Snoopy.
My Life with Snoopy is a book I wrote about my shelter dog. I adopted a shelter dog. See, I had a bad problem when I was a little boy.
Yeah.
I had a puppy when I was 10 years old. His name was Snoopy.
Yeah.
And my parents took him away from me.
Yeah.
Who does that to a kid, a 10-year-old boy?
Why'd they take him away?
They just said, well, you can't feed him or something. They made some bullshit excuse. Oh. I was devastated. Can you imagine if you have a puppy? They give you a puppy, and then they tell you, we're taking it away.
Is this what led to the sex addiction and everything?
Oh, no, more than that. More than that. Yeah. Horrible shit.
Yeah.
So I had, at the age of 40, I adopted this dog from the Burbank Animal Shelter.
Oh.
And the book is called My Life with Snoopy, How One Shelter Dog's Love Changed a Man's Life and Other Tales of Adventure. It's about my 13-year relationship. Because when he died, it was like my kid died.
Yeah.
It's like you and your cats.
Yeah.
It was like
terrible.
I was devastated. I was suicidal.
Oh.
So I wrote this book about him, and it's all my adventures with him. And
that's sweet.
It's a very kid-friendly book.
Oh, that's sweet.
My autobiography is not a kid-friendly book, but The Life with Snoopy is a...
And what's this video with The Life with Snoopy?
No, that's the audio book.
Oh, it's just the audio book.
Yeah, on CDs.
Well, when did you do that?
After I wrote the book, I did it on audio.
Well, when did you write the book? How long ago?
That was 2013.
Oh, you got a new dog?
No, I haven't got a dog since.
Really?
I know, I was so devastated. That's like, I'm scared. I should get another dog.
Yeah.
I know.
You should. So what do you spend your days doing, Joey?
Voiceover.
Yeah.
You know, writing.
Yeah. Trying to get this movie made.
Yeah, get this movie made. So if you know anybody with 1.4 million wants to make a sex addiction movie, just let me know.
We'll put our feelers out there.
Yeah. No, it's been challenging.
Yeah.
You know, it's different. It's good. I've been writing screenplays for a very long time.
Yeah.
You know.
And he sold a few and that never got made?
Just options and got made, you know, that kind of thing.
Show business.
Yeah. I mean, you've written. I mean, so you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just interesting, like, to talk to a guy, you know, like, you know, where, you know, you're a big comic for a long time and then, but show business is, there's a million different things that we do.
Yep.
Yeah, and it's like, it's a great story. Because I talked, like, you know who I talked to? You remember Billy Braver?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was not the greatest story. It was a little sad, you know. But like, you know, like you just keep chipping away. You seem well.
It's no, nice. I'm doing great.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I feel great. You know, I mean, it's show business. I chose it. You know, I mean, I could have been a stockbroker making a lot of money, but I don't want to do that shit.
Yeah, yeah, of course not. Well, I'm glad we did this. It was great talking to you.
You too.
All right.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. That was Joey Kamen. Interesting. Glad I got a chance to talk to him. For all Mark Maron related things, go to WTFpod.com/tour if you want to know the tour dates. Now I'm going to play my new guitar in the same old way that I always play it, the guitar. Yeah, that's what I do. Cat angels everywhere.